Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. We move on to our next guest. It's the great Ray McGovern. For 27 years, he was a CIA analyst, and now he is the co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. He writes at raymcgovern.com and at consortiumnews.com, and he will give a talk to your church group or whoever it is about why they need to be peaceniks and that kind of thing. Look him up there at raymcgovern.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Ray?
Thanks, Scott. I'm doing well.
Very happy to have you on the show. I know you've seen this brand new piece by Seymour Hersh. It's called The Red Line and the Rat Line. I just talked with him for about 20-something minutes about it, something like that. And I guess, well, I'll give you wide open berth here. You just tell us what you think you want us to know about this story, what you think of it, whatever details, and then I'll try to follow up from there. Does that sound all right?
Sure. First, Scott, I'd like to wax poetic, if I may, and borrow from Sir Walter Scott here, who started out saying, Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. But once we've practiced for a while, we markedly improve our style. I have composed that verse for John Kerry, John Brennan, and Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan, who really are exemplars of practicing for a while. They markedly improved their style in lying, and now they have been exposed for the liars that they are and got us 1 inch, or maybe even a half of an inch away from war with Syria on the 1st of September of last year. It's quite a story. Hersh has got chapter and verse, and I'm really, really glad to hear that he gave you 20 minutes just now.
Yeah, me too. He's really great. And there are only a couple of questions I didn't really get to. I guess, first of all, I mean, what could be said about this is it's a circumstantial case. I guess maybe the first part of the circumstantial case is sort of something he saved toward the end, which is that the U.S. intelligence agencies, they just never really believed it at all. I mean, this is old news on this show. We've talked about from the very beginning, from your work and Gareth Porter's work, about how they didn't even release a CIA assessment. They released a government assessment that was written by the White House and was made to sort of sound like a CIA assessment. And then Phil Giraldi wrote in the American Conservative why exactly that was, and that was the threat of a full-scale revolt by the CIA analysts. They were going to all quit en masse, and you know, in a way that couldn't be publicly denied, at least. If they were made to go along with pushing this story. So we've kind of known that there were major problems with this all along. Maybe if you want to elaborate on that or get into the other, you know, parts of the circumstantial case here, you know, that at least it was not Assad and may well have been the Turks and in cooperation with the al-Nusra Front, who, after all, have sworn their loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the good news, Scott. I mean, after my former profession of intelligence analysis was prostituted for the express purpose of deceiving our Congress out of its constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war on Iraq, that's as bad as it gets. And after that debacle, they got a couple of honest people in to run the analysis, Tom Finger did a very good national intelligence estimate on Iran and helped prevent a war against Iran. And now we see the analysts who are still kind of devoted to telling the truth, believe it or not, rising up in arms and saying to the president and saying to General Dempsey, look, we're not going to do another Iraq, you know? And besides, John Kerry, you know, he may have been really good about steering boats up the Mekong, but he doesn't know anything about war. Otherwise, he would never speak of, quote, an unbelievably short war, end quote, in the Middle East. There ain't no such thing. So, Mr. President, Mr. General Dempsey, be aware that we intelligence analysts and our British counterparts won't stand for this anymore. And I don't care what John Brennan, the head of the CIA, says. You're going to hear from us if you perpetrate another war based on fraudulent, I'm not talking mistaken, based on fraudulent intelligence. That's really good news. And, of course, Psy has a lot of that story. The even better news from the point of view of our movement, which we call Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, is that several of the insiders had enough trust in us to share with us what was going on. And so even before the president got bailed out by Vladimir Putin, of all people, and when he seemed to be still going for a vote in Congress, which likely is not, he would have won despite the growing opposition, we served up a memo to him in which we warned that this is what we're hearing from our insiders and that there was all kinds of other evidence out there indicating that someone other than the Bashar al-Assad government was doing this. And that in any case, we could tell him categorically that the Secretary of State, John Kerry, was, well, how shall I say this, was saying untruthful things when he said 35 times on the 30th of August, we know, we know, we know it was Bashar al-Assad that ordered those chemical attacks. He didn't know. He doesn't know now. And I don't have to, you know, I don't have to kind of take it easy on this evidence. Psy is very judicious, and he'll probably say, "Yeah, it's still all circumstantial," but it's a slam dunk for me. If only because the only people that had any incentive to start a chemical attack 2 days after the UN inspectors arrived in Damascus, and with the red line that Barack Obama had foolishly drawn. The only people that have incentive to cross that red line and get the U.S. involved militarily were the rebels who happened to be losing very bad at that point in time.
Right. Well, and I mean, the fact that his article could be Ray McGovern's reporting confirmed or something like that is, you know, I mean, this is what you already said was going on. And now he's coming in with more information, different information, but backing up what your sources inside the CIA were telling you last fall.
Yes, Scott, it's the way it works beautifully, really. You know, even when we were in the analysis division of CIA, we had current intelligence reporters, which was what I did, glorified journalists. You know, we would have to do this every day, and we did it with all the information we could gather, including very sensitive information. But, you know, we depended largely on researchers as well. And when you get one of the few investigative journalists left in this country, another prominent one, of course, is Bob Perry, for whom I write at consortiumnews.com. When you get a guy like Cy Hirsch, who revealed the CIA secrets of the 50s and 60s, who revealed my lie, who revealed Abu Ghraib. I mean, when you get a guy doing the homework, sure, it takes him 2 months longer than it took us, but, you know, ours was, we were sticking our necks out. You know, we didn't really know chapter and verse. Now we do, and it's one of those rare situations where we feel, well, very lucky, but also very convicted that it is still our job to warn the president or to warn anyone else who will listen that he was being mousetrapped and really, really badly mousetrapped. And this business about a unbelievably short war out of Kerry's mouth was not only impossible, but it was a fraud because, as Psy points out, there was big stuff ready. There were the B-52s. They were going to, when the military does anything like this, they do it real big, okay? And we know from the reporting we had even then that the warehouses were being emptied, and it was just going to be sort of a mopping up campaign by the rebels to get rid of Bashar al-Assad after the U.S. had done not an unbelievably short war, but really done to Syria what we did to Iraq in March of 2003.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that case, it wasn't as obvious, at least to many, although Colleen Rowley and others had called it out. I'm sure you had talked about this, but in the case of the Syria war last summer, I mean, this was outright, as Dennis Kucinich called it, would have been America acting as al-Qaeda's air force. I mean, when every rebel group on the ground is sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, they just can't decide, you know, the order of rank on the ground in Syria and who's more loyal to him, maybe, between the so-called Islamic Front, ISIS, and Nusra. All of these guys, as Patrick Coburn says on the show repeatedly, has said for years now, there's no real distinction between, you know, how bin Ladenite these forces are. They all are 100%. The only question is, you know, I'm not taking orders from you, pal, that kind of thing on the ground. But otherwise,
yeah,
that would be who's inheriting Damascus. If America B-52'd them out of power, that would be who wins the regime change, would be the suicide bombers.
Well, it would, you know, it would be up for grabs for a while. And, you know, the real people, you know, when you ask cui bono, who is this really supposed to benefit? Well, let me put it this way. Judy Rudoran, who writes for the New York Times, had an article just at about this time, and she had asked a very senior Israeli official, what's your preferred outcome of Syria? And he said, oh, that's easy, no outcome. And she said, I beg your pardon? Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, no outcome. Oh, we got the Sunni and the Shia at each other's throats, not only in Syria, but throughout the whole area. You know, to the degree they're killing off each other, you know, we're pretty, relatively safe. So, yeah, no outcome, please. Now, why do I mention that? I mention that because Bashar al-Assad's forces were starting to win. They drove the rebels out of chief rebel territory in July and August of last year. And so, you know, there was a lot of incentive for the neoconservatives in our country, Kerry among them, who really have trouble distinguishing between the strategic needs of Israel, as Israel sees it, and the strategic needs of the United States. They saw a big incentive to get in there with both feet militarily, so Bashar al-Assad wouldn't continue to win, and the thing would go on forever. Now, once the U.S. is in, Scott, as much as the rebels are unalterably opposed to the United States, well, we can always gin up, special forces squads and all, and can keep this thing going for years. And I think that's what the Israelis and the neoconservatives, including John Kerry, were aiming for, pure and simple.
Mm-hmm. And then so now let's go back to your reporting, the VIPS reporting here. Obama warned on Syrian intel at consortiumnews.com from last September the 6th. Where you talk about plotting going on inside Turkey. Now, one thing that you have in here that Seymour Hersh certainly doesn't write about is Americans. I think you say John Brennan's men in Turkey as part of this conspiracy, or to what degree is part of this conspiracy to arm up al-Nusra with sarin?
Well, Scott, you always have to keep in touch with people, no matter how reprobate they are. And that's the CIA operative's job. So the notion that there were CIA operatives with the folks among the rebels, the various rebel groups, and that they were kind of aware that this was going to happen and actually were in some kind of control of the warehouses where all these weapons were stored doesn't surprise me in the least. They're taking orders from John Brennan. John Brennan was in with John Kerry, like two peas in a pod, in trying to launch this war. We know that because our friends within the CIA told us that. So these people are keeping a watchful eye on what's going on. They're reporting back to Brennan, okay? And they're thinking that they're making him happy. It was the people on the other side of the CIA, the analysis division, who came through and said, "No, we're not going to do this stuff anymore. We're not going to dovetail the evidence. We're not even going to do a statement for you because it will never satisfy you." And that's why, as you correctly pointed out, we had a sui generis, a new genre of report. It was not an intelligence assessment. It was a, quote, government assessment, end quote. And we smelled a rat right away.
Right, yeah, I mean, I'm surprised they even tried that one, really. I guess they had to come up with something in a hurry, and it would be good enough for MSNBC and Fox, so why not, I guess, you know?
Sure, you know, and Kerry was dead set in doing this, you know. I have to say that, you know, next week I mark my 52nd year in Washington. Seen a lot of change, but I had never seen a situation set up this way where Kerry, 35 times at the State Department in the afternoon of August 30 last year, says, "We know it was Bashar al-Assad. We know, okay? And we know that this president has a red line, and so we know we're going to have to retaliate." And everyone's talking about these cruise missile ships that we have in the Mediterranean. And within 22 hours, the president gets up in the Rose Garden, and he says, "The chairman of the Joint Chiefs has told me that we're in position to strike Syria, but we don't have to do it today, we don't have to do it tomorrow, or next week, or next month, and so I'm going to ask for congressional authorization to do this." Wow! I was outside the White House at the time. We were shouting, "Hands off Syria," right? We were incredibly surprised and really, really happy about that. Now, why did that happen? That happened because General Dempsey was in receipt of this honest assessment from the British that that sarin was not from Syrian government stocks, okay? And our guys in the CIA were protesting that they weren't going to fool around with the intelligence anymore, and they'd be held to pay if they started a war and our analysts decided to seek an opportunity to tell the real story. So the president, to his credit, I suppose, changed his mind within 22 hours. Now, what did that mean? That meant that he had to call the Israelis or have somebody call them and say, "Look, we're not going to do it. You can relax your defenses." And then he had to call the French. You know, "Turn off the engines on your fighter bombers that you have on the tarmac. We're not going to do it." Now, that took a lot of guts and a lot of... Now, who helped him out on that? Did John Kerry? No way. John Kerry's in Europe, and he's coming back, and somebody asked him at a press conference, "Now, Secretary Kerry, is there nothing at all that Bashar al-Assad can do to avoid being hit militarily by the United States forces?" And Kerry says, "Well, I mean, he can give up all his chemical weapons, but that's not going to happen. He's not going to do that." Okay. Now, 2 hours later, when Kerry's in the plane going back to Washington, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, gets up and says, "I think the Syrians are willing to destroy all their chemical weapons." And sure enough, Syrian foreign minister gets up 2 hours later and says, "Yeah, we'll do that." Who bails the president out? Vladimir Putin. And it's clear, and I see that Sai includes this, that Putin and Obama had been talking about all this behind Kerry's back, trying to work this thing out with the chemical weapons. And by the time they made this agreement, they had working groups already working on it. And so it was concluded in record time. Within 3 days, they had this agreement. And then, you know, the rest of the story. No war. The chemicals destroyed. Putin saving the president. Now, as you probably remember, Scott, I come from the Bronx, right? And we used to watch Gene Autry movies all the time, right? And you know, he would get in trouble with what they call the Iroquois Indians, okay? And they used to have real, you know, terrible things they do to Gene Autry. And this one time, this commentator was saying, you know, here's another film, and these Iroquois Indians, they hate Gene Autry so much. They hate him from another picture. They hate him from the movie last year, okay? that's how the neocons hate Vladimir Putin. He bailed out our president. They didn't get their war. And that explains in large measure why they wanted to create this distrust, this animus between Moscow and Washington, which we haven't seen a like of for many decades. That's why, even if they failed in Ukraine, which they did, the consolation prize is this enmity that they've sown between Putin and everybody else. Putin, no shirt on, bad Putin, bad, bad Putin, no shirt, rides horseback, bad, bad Putin. it's ridiculous.
Okay, now here's the thing. I just take it for granted, actually, at this point, that could really hamper and will probably really hamper any effort of the Americans to work with the Russians to try to end the violence. Like you said, they don't really want that anyway. And if the pressure was ever on them to do it, this could really help sabotage it. I'd put money on it that the war in Syria, that America and Russia will not see eye to eye on Syria and really resolve the fighting there anytime soon, and partially because of this. But so my real question then is, what about the Iran nuclear deal? I mean, the center, most at least, the majority of the American establishment, they're really behind Obama on this, and they really do want to have a final nuclear deal. And it ain't the Russians making the Iranians do this anyway, right? And so do you think that this will really be a problem with the upcoming nuclear deal?
I don't, Scott. I don't see Russian interests diverging very much from American interests on this. And, you know... Okay, it might be the first time, but Obama is showing some backbone on this one, you know? I mean, so let's give him a break and say, well, maybe he's got enough backbone to see this thing through. He certainly has pretty adroitly arranged the forces in Washington so that, you know, Congress isn't breathing down his neck too much on sabotaging these things. But their potential for sabotage is great, and so is the Israeli potential to sabotage on this. And the first time this all was going to be worked out, at the end of Obama's first year in office, October of 2009, there was an attack on Revolutionary Guard generals in southern Iran, killed five of them, okay? By what group? Well, it was a group called Jandala, who has been sort of set up, financed by the Israelis, by the U.S., sometimes by the PACs. And how did they get that expert intelligence to kill five Revolutionary Guard generals in this outpost? Well, I don't know how they got it, but they screwed up the talks. Those talks were supposed to start the next day in Vienna, and the Revolutionary Guards guys went to the Supreme Leader, to whom they report, and said, hey, you're going to deal with these perfidious Americans when they just, when they and their friends, the Israelis, just took out five of our generals? And that put the kibosh on that thing for a whole year until it was resurrected by the Brazilians and the Turks, and they had a deal, and that was scuttled by Hillary Clinton.
Well, we came to find out later that those Jandala, at least that time around, if not, you know, back in the Bush years, at least that time around, Jandala had been hired by Mossad posing as CIA. Or did you ever confirm that story from foreignpolicy.com?
Well, I didn't take the trouble to try to confirm that with my friends, but it's entirely plausible.
Yeah, that was actually...
So all I'm saying here is that there are all kinds of ways to derail this thing. I think Putin is not going to be the guy to derail it.
And, you know, it's funny that those of us who know that Iran's nuclear program is nothing to worry about are the ones most obsessed with getting this nuclear deal, just because we want this red herring out of the way and you know, hopefully can, you know, start forging a peaceful relationship. But I hate to make it sound like it's really an emergency, that something needs to be done about what Iran is doing.
On its face, Scott, you know, what we're saying is... We're not going to deal with you Iranians until you stop working on that nuclear weapons program that we know you stopped working on 10 years ago. So you better stop it.
Yeah. Well, or the one that, as Gareth Porter's shown in his new book, never existed 10 years ago or 20 either.
Yeah, that's a great book, The Manufactured Crisis, and it's an incredibly apt title.
Yeah,
purely manufactured. It's quite remarkable how, if you read the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, you never ever see the notion that the U.S. Intelligence Committee at the end of 2007 said that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003. Right. And if my arithmetic is correct, that's more than 10 years ago.
Right. Yeah, that's the worst case scenario, that they haven't worked on it since then. All right. Well, you know what? We're already pretty much out of time. I know you got to go a little bit early here, so I'll go ahead and let you go. But I'll thank you very much for your time on the show today, Ray.
You're most welcome, Scott. Good luck.
I hope we talk again. In fact, I'll probably call you in a day or two to catch up on Ukraine, too, because there's a lot going on there still. All right. Thanks.
There is.
All right, everybody, that is the great Ray McGovern. He's at raymcgovern.com. You can also find him at consortiumnews.com. And so you heard it, his stamp of approval on what Seymour Hersh has written here in the London Review of Books, The Red Line and the Rat Line, Hersh, on Obama, Erdogan, and the Syrian rebels. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com.